You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, Yusuf.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
Good. Good to see you.
Good to see you. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright. This is The Wright Show, available on both streaming video and via audio podcast at a podcast app near you. You are Yusuf Munayyer, the executive director of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. Is that right?
That is right.
And that is itself a coalition of NGOs or what?
Yeah, it's a coalition of over 330 different organizations throughout the United States, big and small organizations across the country working to advocate for Palestinian rights in the United States.
Okay. So we're going to talk about the events that unfolded a few days ago at the border between along the border between Gaza and Israel. Started off as a protest that had been long in the making from the Gaza side. A number of protesters were shot by Israeli soldiers. The last number I saw of deaths was that 17 had died. In at least some cases, there is video seeming to indicate that they posed no threat to the Israeli soldiers when they were shot. We can talk about that in more detail. But first, why don't we provide people with some background? And maybe we should, before we talk about the march and its purpose, maybe we should provide kind of deep historical background. Of course, Israel was, I guess, created by the UN in 1948.
Yes, you have the UN Partition Plan resolution in 1947, but ultimately Israel was created out of a war that took place in 1948, where at the time Zionist militias were able to conquer the majority of the territory, what is today Israel, after the war, during which there were hundreds of thousands of Palestinian refugees created that allowed what was a Jewish minority in Palestine to become a Jewish majority in what would become Israel. After that war, of course, the international recognition of Israel followed from different states, and ultimately they also became a member state of the United Nations as well. That's, 1947 through 1949. And of course, what we saw in the last several days, has its origins in those, early moments. The Gaza Strip, of course, which is today home to about 2 million people, the majority of its inhabitants are not originally from Gaza, but are refugees from towns and villages surrounding the Gaza Strip that sought refuge in Gaza and became refugees in camps there after the war in 1948. And so one of the goals of this march, and we can talk more about that later on, but one of the goals of this march was to assert the right of Palestinian refugees in Gaza to be able to go home to the lands and the towns and the villages from which they are originally from and from which they were forced to flee during the war and were never able to return to because of the creation of the state of Israel.
And that would include descendants of inhabitants of those homes. I mean, I assume by now most of the people in Gaza didn't actually live in the homes, but they are either they did live in those homes or they are direct descendants of their offspring or grand offspring or whatever. And of course, this is the phrase right of return you hear every once in a while. It's traditionally been thought of as kind of a sticking point in negotiations because, I guess Israelis would say, well, these homes are occupied now. If you let all the people back who say they have a claim to these homes, that would completely alter the demographics. I don't know what the numbers would be, but anyway, it's considered a non-starter pretty much from the Israeli side. And sometimes you hear, proposals where everyone would nominally have the right of return, but there would be ways to compensate some if they chose to accept compensation in lieu of actual return. But in any event, it's been so long since peace talks got anywhere near any kind of resolution that it's almost pointless to talk about possible ways of actually working this issue out through negotiation. But in any event, this thing was called, and maybe one more thing we should say for the sake of people who really don't pay much attention to this, is there's two populations of Palestinians on Israel's border. There's the West Bank, which is to the east of Israel, is administered, well, to varying degrees directly by Israel. Sometimes the administration is kind of outsourced in some regions and in some cases less so. But in any event, Gaza is a little different because Israel just chose to withdraw, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, without really negotiating the status of what would happen afterwards. But they withdrew. So there's no troops in, Israeli troops in Gaza, but, there is a kind of a, they control, Israel in effect controls the borders. There's an Egyptian border, but, the current, Egyptian administration is more or less playing along with what Israel wants to do, right? Is that a fair?
Yeah. Summary? So there's a difference in circumstances between what's going on in the Gaza Strip and what's going on in the West Bank. But as far as international law is concerned, it's a distinction without a difference. And it's one of the reasons why, you know, you use the term border, and I myself have used that sometimes. It's very problematic because it kind of suggests that there's some sort of international recognized boundary there, but that's not the case. The only demarcation between Israel and the Gaza Strip was an armistice line after the war in 1949. Israel, of course, occupied the West Bank, East Jerusalem, the Gaza Strip in 1967, and became the belligerent occupant of those territories from that point forward. And continued
belligerent in a legal sense of the term, I take it you mean.
Right. This is the term under international law. And of course, there are, you know, rules and regulations that apply to the occupier as far as international humanitarian law is concerned, that charges them with the well-being of the civilian population in occupied territory. And just because you don't necessarily have troops on the ground within a particular space doesn't mean you don't still occupy it, because you exercise what the international legal standard is of effective control. And so by controlling what gets in and out of Gaza, and essentially entering Gaza at will, both its airspace, land, and sea space anytime that they want, the Israelis exercise effective control over the Gaza Strip and still occupy it, and under international law are responsible for the well-being of the civilian population there. So it's important to keep in mind, you know, we, in a lot of the reporting that we've seen over the last several days, there's been, you know, reporting about so-called clashes at the so-called border. And it creates the impression that there is this, you know, this separation of space wherein the Palestinians are on one side, the Israelis are on another. And if the Palestinians somehow cross or challenge that line, they've crossed some kind of border, which internationally recognized border, which is not the case. The Israelis are still effectively controlling the Gaza Strip. So it's not as if, you know, the Israelis talk about this as securing their border from infiltrators. It's not as if these are, you know, people entering into an across an internationally recognized border from a foreign country. This is still Israeli-occupied territory, and Israel has obligations to the civilians there, and is restricting their freedom of movement. So these are all important nuances that I think have to be kept in the frame of the conversation.
Okay, and one more little historical point. As for the fact that leaving aside the occupation part, but as for why those borders are armistice lines, the original allotment of land by the UN was smaller than what we think of as Israel proper now, which is itself defined by that broader set of lines that are armistice lines. And the reason for that is the original allotment led to conflict. Through the conflict, as you said, Israel expanded the territory it controlled beyond the original allotment to include Jerusalem, which wasn't part of the original package. And then that war, that culminated in what is technically an armistice. So that there's some kind of technical difference between armistice lines and actually recognized borders. So there's that complication. Right. Do you want to say something?
And just for the purpose of the numbers, the 1947 partition plan, you know, during that time, the Jewish population was close to about 30% of the total population of the territory. And the remainder was Palestinian, Arab, Muslim, and Christian. The allotment, though, was about 55% of the territory for what would become the Jewish state, and 45% of the territory for what would then be the Arab state. And at the end of the war, what had resulted was that the newly created state of Israel had laid claim to 78% of the territory. So a significant increase from what was allotted to them under the partition plan.
Okay, and one final thing about the control Israel exerts. There is a blockade, right? An economic blockade. It doesn't prohibit all exports and imports, but there is selectivity about what's allowed in and out of Gaza. It includes, it isn't just along the, what you would call the so-called border between Gaza and Israel, but it's enforced in the ocean as well. So of course, if Gaza were a nation, that would, I think, be deemed an act of war to put ships around a country and say, you can't, we get to control what comes in and out. So there is the blockade, and it is, I think Israel has eased up somewhat on it, but it is still not just a munitions blockade, right? I mean, certainly, I don't know. No. It's broader than that.
No, it's certainly broader than that. And so over the decades, the occupation has involved many different forms of limitation on freedom of movement. But after 2005, which is when Israel began to withdraw its presence on the ground in the Gaza Strip to exert control from the outside, the degree of restrictions grew. And so from 2005 until now, you've seen a very, very tight siege. It was tightened again in 2006 and 2007. And you almost have a, compared to where it was before that, total restriction on exports, a very, very limited number of imports. We learned from reporting that's been done by Israeli human rights organizations that the Israeli agencies that are responsible for these kinds of matters actually calculated the precise caloric intake necessary to keep Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, able to sustain life, and based the number of truckloads that would go into the Gaza Strip, with humanitarian supplies on those calculations. And so the limitations on movement are designed to really keep life at a sustainable minimum, while at the same time absolutely obliterating the economy within the Strip, keeping it very, very dependent and incapable of being successful. This has had a devastating impact on industries in the Gaza Strip. And several years ago, we saw a collapse of industries in the Gaza Strip, to the point now where, the vast majority of people in the Gaza Strip are dependent on outside aid agencies for their daily sustenance. Okay. So this was a calculated policy of de-development. People will point to the Gaza Strip and they'll say, they had an opportunity to do something with it and make it great. But in reality, they never really had an opportunity because they were never allowed to function independently.
And what does Israel say about why the blockade goes so far beyond just keeping munitions out? I mean, I'm sure they don't describe it the way you did as a strategy of de-development. What is their line?
Well, Israeli officials have described in a lot of different ways over time. You know, one Israeli official described it as putting Gaza on a diet in the past. So, you know, they talk about the need to ensure security. But if this was just about security, it would be just about preventing, you know, weapons from getting in or whatever else. But it's not just about that. It's also about collapsing the economy. You know, if this was about preventing weapons from getting in, they would, you know, allow shipments from Gaza to get out to the outside world to allow them to be able to function economically. But they deny the vast majority of exports as well. There are entire industries in the Gaza Strip that used to actually manufacture and produce a lot of agricultural things, as well as flowers and fruit products and so on, that would get exported outside of the Gaza Strip. That doesn't happen anymore. These shipments have been reduced to almost zero. And you know, you also have the fishing industry in the Gaza Strip, because of this naval blockade, as you pointed out, there are restrictions on the extent to which Palestinian fishermen are able to go into the sea to fish. And under agreements that have been signed between the parties during the peace process, that limit was supposed to be at about 20 nautical miles. But over the course of the siege that we've seen since 2005, that has been limited at times to as little as 3 nautical miles, which has created an overfishing problem for the Strip. And for the first time in its history, and we're talking about an area that has been, you know, populated and for a very, very long time in history, for the first time in its history, most of the fish in Gaza in the period of the siege are being produced through on-land farms, fishing farms. Because the fishing industry has been debilitated by the naval blockade. So the policies are calculated to really make the economy flatline.
Okay. So so let's talk about this march. Now, I gather it was initiated. The idea came from some social media activists or something. Eventually, Hamas kind of got on board. Hamas, of course... I mean, Americans may think of it as been designated, I guess, by the U.S. government as a terrorist organization, right? But in Gaza, I mean, Hamas provides a lot of social services and so on, and so it's thought of differently there. But in any event, the name was the Great Return March, and I gather that is an allusion to the aspiration to return to homes in Israel, right? Was that the main kind of thing on the agenda?
Yeah, I think that was a big part of it. I think it was about a lot of different things as well. Mm-hmm. I think it was about asserting the fact that, you know, Palestinians in Gaza are not going anywhere. There is this, you know, often talked about idea in right-wing circles in Israel and as well in the United States that, you know, maybe we can just erase Gaza, push them off into Egypt, and then you don't have to even think about that problem, out of sight, out of mind. Mm-hmm. And with the pressure that has been put on Palestinians in Gaza throughout the siege, you know, the message that Palestinians there are getting is that this really is calculated to making life unsustainable there, to basically force them out, and to just erase them from existence. And so it was in part, you know, talking about the right of refugees to return, but also a message, I think an important message that was sent to the Israelis that you can't ignore us. You can't pretend that we don't exist. You can't just push us off into Egypt or make us go away. We're here. We're not going anywhere. And we're going to make sure that you recognize that. So it was about defiance. It was about asserting their presence. And what I think is also really important and maybe missed by many is, you know, you had talked about the role of Hamas in all of this. Yes, Hamas is a major player in Gaza. It is the de facto government there. If they didn't want this march to happen, I'm sure they would have prevented it from happening. But when I looked at the videos from the march and when I looked at the images of the march, and there is a lot of video and images, I really scoured everything that I could find to find any sense of factional identification. And you can't find any Hamas flags there. You can't find any Fatah flags there. The message that the organizers wanted to put out, and I think they put out very effectively, is that this is a Palestinian march. This isn't about Hamas or Fatah or any other faction. This is about the interests of the Palestinian people. And I think that's one of the reasons why they were able to successfully mobilize the number of people that they did and organize it in the way that they did.
Okay, so now I had said, was return the main thing on the agenda. I didn't mean by that, what was there a plan to actually march during this protest to the homes? There wasn't. That said, Israel, I think, I read a New York Times piece suggesting, the protest organizers had been vague about what exactly was going to happen with respect to the so-called border fence, like, were they going to try to breach it? Were they going to try to reach it? Were they whatever? And that I think the implication was that this had made it harder for Israel to respond without the use of force. Their uncertainty about, like, what exactly was going to unfold. What is your take on that? Was it fairly clear, like, what this was, you know, where the line was going to be drawn by the protesters and so on, or what? Because the other thing is, I think Israel said in advance, if you get within 100 yards of the fence or something like that, some distance, you do so at your own risk, kind of?
Yeah, I mean, look, the Israelis have never really waited for input or engagement with the Palestinian side to determine how they're going to enforce the situation on the ground in Gaza. For years, they have arbitrarily enforced what they call a buffer zone inside the Gaza Strip. So that if anyone approaches within a certain distance of the fence there, they open fire. People have been killed as far away as 1,500 to 1,700 meters from the fence and as close as within 100 meters of the fence. So where exactly that line is can vary by the day. And on many occasions, including in recent weeks, Palestinian farmers have been killed in their farmland while they were just doing work there by Israeli snipers on the Israeli side of the fence. So this is not something new. I think Palestinians knew that there was a real chance that the Israelis were going to open fire on them, because that's something that they routinely do. Now, as far as, you know, whether or not them approaching the fence is some sort of justification for using the means that the Israelis did is another question altogether. Under international law, the use of lethal force is only supposed to be an option that is chosen when there is an imminent threat to the life of the people doing the firing, right? So in this scenario, you have Israeli military snipers armed to the hilt, okay, behind a fence on top of sand dunes with armored personnel vehicles, with very sophisticated intelligence apparatus, aerial supremacy, and a mass of unarmed Palestinian protesters on the other side, with maybe every once in a while someone who was throwing a rock, okay? Even if you grant that there may have been rock throwers here, and the majority of the pictures that we've seen all show masses of peaceful protesters throughout, even if you grant rock throwing, there's no justification for the use of lethal force. But the soldiers were sent down there ahead of this march, 100 army snipers, as the Israeli media reported, with orders to shoot people who were approaching the fence. Whether or not they constituted any real threat or not was not part of what their orders were. It's very clear here that this was a firing squad, is essentially what it was. And whenever they decided they wanted to, they chose to open fire, which is why you saw, I think, the numbers that you did with, you know, hundreds of Palestinians who were injured by live ammunition, and 17 people who were killed. And I think, as we've seen in statements from some members of the international community and human rights organizations, this is a flagrant violation of international law.
So now Israel said that there was one case, and I guess this video is available, that they have video of one case. There was a Palestinian who had a gun and was shooting it or something and was shot. But I have to say there's certainly plenty of video of the kind you describe where people are shot who seem to pose no threat. I mean, a couple that I've seen, one was a person just kind of running away from you couldn't see the soldiers, but it's pretty clear running away from them. And I don't know how close they'd gotten. Maybe they'd gotten close, but an unarmed person running away, shot, they fall. A more well-known one was this guy who I think died, who he was carrying a tire. And we should say one thing I guess people are doing, you know, I mean, famously you set tires on fire during protests sometimes. And I guess in some cases maybe they were setting them on tire and rolling them toward the fence or something. I don't know. But in any event, this was not a tire on fire, just a tire. You had one Palestinian running with the tire, and you saw, you know, gunfire hitting around his feet or something. He kind of goes down or falters. An ally of his, a Palestinian, runs up, grabs the tire from him, continues to run, presumably away from the Israelis, and he's the one who was shot and killed. And then there's one guy shot, wounded, I guess, while kneeling in prayer, and his friend said previous to that he had been close to the fence, but whatever. So there's a lot of you know, there's a lot of video showing, I guess, what you say, that certainly by American standards, I mean, you know, if like a cop did this, it would be like open and shut. I mean, there's much tougher calls than this that lead to uproars in America in terms of police using violence. Now, has Israel said anything about this? As you said, some human rights organizations have complained. The UN Security Council didn't do anything because the U.S. vetoed it. Nikki Haley cast the vote for the veto, I gather, right? There was some declaration that that the rest of the Security Council was fine with. Is that the case?
Yeah, the Security Council had a meeting. They had an opportunity to, you know, each, you know, give their statement at the time. But a Security Council presidential statement was basically stymied by U.S. opposition. There wasn't a resolution that was brought before that would, you know, allow for an opportunity for a veto or a vote in general. But the process of a statement is something that needs to be supported by, you know, the different players, particularly the veto powers. And, you know, the U.S. And its ambassador, Nikki Haley, put a stop to that. And, you know, the message that this sends to Israel is that, yeah, go ahead, shoot unarmed protesters, even do it on camera, that's fine. The United States is here to support you as you do that. And you asked about, you know, what the Israelis had said about this. The Israeli defense minister, which is, you know, in charge for the military there, commended the soldiers for what they had done and for allowing, you know, Israelis to have a quiet holiday is the way that he had put it. So, you know, as far as Israelis are concerned, the state, you know, this is something that they fully authorize. And again, this is not new. You know, this is something that if you follow the situation near the fence is actually quite regular. What we haven't seen is the scale of mobilization and organized protest on the Palestinian side that we saw here that created the circumstances that allowed for mass targeting by the Israeli forces. But, you know, earlier this year, I want to say it was in maybe early January or late December, you know, the Israelis at one point, you know, shot a man with no legs who was known for coming to the border area to hold up a Palestinian flag in protest. His name was Ibrahim Abu Thuraya, and he had lost his legs in previous wars in the Gaza Strip, and he'd still come down to protest. And here's a double amputee who clearly poses no threat to the Israeli military, and he was shot in the head and killed. So, you know, if you follow these things at the fence in Gaza, the use of lethal force against unarmed civilians is the norm. And, you know, what we saw on Friday was just that on a much larger scale.
Okay. And by the way, how large was the protest? How many protesters were mobilized, roughly?
You know, what I saw in terms of estimates was in the tens of thousands. So I think I saw a couple estimates between 20 and 40,000. It's, of course, really hard to tell. It's the largest mobilization in that part of the Gaza Strip that I have ever seen images of. It was organized in a number of different spots around cities throughout the Strip that ranged from the northern part of the Strip down to the south along the fence. And so I think there were six different sort of encampment spots. They had set up tents. And the ideas that were put out there by the organizers at the outset was that this was supposed to be a sustained demonstration that would start on the 30th of March, which is a land day, a day that Palestinians commemorate marking the killing of several Palestinian citizens of Israel who were protesting the confiscation of Palestinian land by the state in 1976. And so this is a day that is annually marked. And so these events were supposed to start on land day, but continue in a sustained fashion until May 15th, which is, of course, the day that Israel marks as its Independence Day. Palestinians mark it as a day that signifies the depopulation of Palestine in 1948, and is also, of course, this year the day that the United States intends to open its embassy in Jerusalem as well. And so this was supposed to be a sustained event, not just across that space, but also over that period of time.
Okay, and has what happened altered the prospects for making it a sustained demonstration? I mean, what does it look like is going to happen in the coming days and weeks?
Well, immediately after the massacre, there was a mourning period. The encampments are still there, as far as I could tell. There were lots of people who stayed there. And I imagine this is something that will continue. I think the organizers knew that, you know, this could happen, that the Israelis have been known to use lethal force, and that, you know, with little to restrain them, that they may very well use lethal force on a mass scale. But I think, you know, for Palestinians in Gaza, you know, they really see these kinds of tactics as a last resort for the situation that they're in. You know, they see that the path of negotiations has really led nowhere. They see that the use of, you know, militancy and violence is not a strategic option against a state that is as powerful as Israel and has led to massive costs on the Palestinian side. And at the same time, the situation in the Gaza Strip is extremely desperate. The humanitarian conditions are very poor. The economic conditions are very poor. And you have a situation now with a lack of water, you know, drinkable water, and a real scarcity of electricity that's making life very, very difficult in the Gaza Strip. And so I think, you know, for many people in Gaza, they understand that there are major risks with protesting against these Israeli policies, but nonetheless are adamant about continuing to do so, because really, what are the alternatives?
Yeah. Now, as for the Israeli kind of logic behind what seems to have been, a kind of thought out strategy of shooting at people who did not pose any immediate threat to the troops. I mean, do you think the logic is like, well, if there's tens of thousands of aggrieved Palestinians on that side of the fence, what happens if they just start marching? Toward, what if they all just start crossing the fence and marching peacefully? You know, the demonstrations had been by and large peaceful. What if they approach the fence in mass, start climbing over it. I mean, I guess it has what? It's chain link with barbed wire or something. But you know, it's something you could get over. And they just, what if they just keep on coming? Tens of thousands of people marching toward Israeli villages. What do we do then? I assume the thinking is something like, send them a message early before that happens, right? I mean, is that your sense of what the calculation is?
Yeah, I actually think that the mobilization that took place, which again, was well organized and overwhelmingly nonviolent, really unnerved the Israelis. Not because there was a potential for violence, but rather precisely because it was nonviolent. And I think the Israelis are very well equipped and used to dealing with militant threats and violent threats. They know how to deal with it. They put a bullet in it and it's done. What they don't know how to deal with is nonviolent civil disobedience. And I think they were terrified at the prospect of this tactic becoming widely embraced in a sustained fashion. And because of that, as you said, wanted to try to quash this thing early and make it clear that any attempts at doing so would come at a massive cost and that they were not messing around. Because, you know, what the Israelis are used to doing is sending the world this message that we have to defend ourselves. This is about security. And, you know, by and large, the international community is sympathetic to that message when it comes from Israel. But that narrative falls apart when what you're up against is nonviolent civil disobedience. And it becomes much more difficult for the Israelis to then defend the policies that they have when it looks like you're shooting unarmed protesters, which is what they're doing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Palestinians here, I think, have a tremendous opportunity. And this is really an Achilles heel for the Israelis because at the same time as they are ruling over millions of Palestinians with brute force, denying them the right to self-determination, they're simultaneously selling themselves to the world as some sort of liberal democracy, right? And the tactic of nonviolent civil disobedience actually exposes that for the sham that it is, because it puts those policies on trial without the distractions of, well, this is about security, this is about terrorism, this is about a threat to Israel, and so on. It forces that confrontation. And it's because of that that the Israelis actually, well before this event, attempted to try to frame it as some sort of violent gathering. Mm-hmm. And if you saw in the days before the event, I actually heard much more about this event in the lead up to it from the Israelis than I did the Palestinian organizers who were behind it. The Israelis were putting out information. This is put on by Hamas. It's a cover for terrorist activity. It's, you know, they're going to be charging defense. None of those things happened. Mm-hmm. But it was put out there to lay the foundation for what they were preparing to do. And frankly, this is a lesson that they learned from what was the Flotilla Massacre, if you recall, in 2010, where a number of ships organized by civilian protesters wanted to challenge the naval blockade of the Gaza Strip. And what ended up happening was that the Israelis intercepted the ships with their military, naval commandos descended on the ships of civilians, and ultimately nine people ended up being killed. Nine civilians ended up being killed. It started an international diplomatic incident with Turkey, and which, you know, to this day has never really been fully healed. But one of the interesting focuses of the investigative reports that the Israeli state did into the events that took place around the Flotilla massacre was the conclusion that they came away with, which was the problem wasn't that we killed these unarmed protesters. The problem was we didn't do a good enough job explaining why we were gonna do so beforehand. And so their conclusion was, we came to the PR battle late in the game, and so we can't do that anymore. We have to be prepared for these kind of things ahead of time. And when I started to see, you know, all these Israeli official mouthpieces, you know, a week ahead of this march, put out all these messages about violence and so on that they anticipate, it became very, very clear that they were laying the groundwork for a massacre.
Okay. So you alluded to the, from your point of view, the promise of nonviolent resistance, and precisely because it puts Israel in an awkward position, you know, it's become a cliche. I mean, for decades, you know, where is the Palestinian Mandela? You know, why isn't there more of that? And, you know, one thing I've asked, and I may have asked you before, no, but like, why not? And this might be a particularly salient kind of tactic in the West Bank, because it's clearer there that Israel is ruling the West Bank in a very hands-on way, and yet does not let Palestinians vote in Israeli elections. And so they're being ruled by a power that they have no say in, you know, in kind of selecting. And I've said, well, why don't you just say, look, we just want the vote, period. Now, you hear two things. One is that, well, no, but to say you want to vote in an Israeli election is to, quote, normalize the occupation. It is to, you know, it is to kind of say, it is to grant a kind of legitimacy to the Israeli rule over the area, to say that we should vote in Israeli and so on. You hear that. You also hear sometimes people say, you don't understand how hard Israel has worked to sabotage incipient nonviolent movements. And I've never really understood. I've never gotten details on that. Let me, I'm interested in your response to this, maybe both of those. But first, is it your sense that there has been the bubbling up of kind of nonviolent resistance, and that Israel has done things to actually nip it in the bud? And if so, what are those things?
Yeah, well, you know, first, in terms of the Palestinian Mandela, you're right that it's a cliche. I think what people often forget is that before, you know, Nelson Mandela was apartheid, with the apartheid South African government, you could find him in an apartheid prison for most of his adult life. And there are many, many Palestinians who are sitting in Israeli prisons right now, including, you know, political leaders, who, you know, could one day play a role like that, perhaps. But this idea that, you know, there's somewhere out there this missing, you know, Palestinian leader, and where is he? I think, you know, really doesn't understand the ways in which state repression works. It's actually quite sophisticated, of course, not just in Israel, but everywhere. You have had, throughout Palestinian history, many, many different organized nonviolent efforts. In fact, I would say that the majority of nonviolent Palestinian resistance to Zionism, even predating the State of Israel, has been in nonviolent forms. The kind, of course, that we hear the most about is the violent resistance, because, you know, that leads to the most headlines, that leads to the most death tolls.
And, of course, part of this depends on how you, excuse me, how you define violence. I mean, Israel would say if you're throwing rocks, that's violence. You may not be including, you know, throwing rocks at well-armed soldiers on the other side of a checkpoint as violence, right? But there is that question.
Yeah, I think it's also important to think about the modalities of state violence as well, right? When you have restrictions on movement that are imposed on people at the barrel of a gun, that very much is violence as well, even if you don't pull the trigger, right? It is the use of violence to create certain systems of checks and balances that hold people outside of their natural condition of freedom, right? So it's systemic in a way that we often don't talk about, and interacts with resistance as well. So that has a lot to do with what shapes and forms resistance.
Okay.
The case that we saw here in Gaza, you had, you know, masses of people who were overwhelmingly nonviolent. And the response from the Israeli state was to deploy their army snipers, you know. So the message to Palestinians about where the Israeli intentions are very clear here. They're intending to take this in a direction of violence. And so, you know, whenever we talk about sort of repression and dissent, the violence goes in both directions off of each other, and oftentimes it's state repression that can lead to violence more than the actions of the dissenters. And that's, of course, something that's true everywhere, not just in Israel and Palestine.
Okay. So where do you see this going, first of all? And then I'll ask you a larger kind of question about where things are going. But you think that this particular protest will continue in visible form? And do you anticipate more people dying, or what do you see?
I imagine that this will continue. I'm not sure for how long it will go on, but I think that the organizers have made clear that this is something that they want to continue through the 15th of May. I think they were well aware that, you know, this was a possibility, even a likelihood. But I think there are great risks to simply walking away, at this point, because there was a great deal of hope that was created on the ground. You know, when you saw the masses of Palestinians who were gathering under a Palestinian flag, not under a factional banner, which is something, you know, that has plagued the Palestinian national movement for over a decade now, this factional division. When you saw people gathering in that way, asserting their rights and doing so nonviolently, you know, that's something that Palestinians of all backgrounds can really gather around. And to abandon that at this point, I think would be really demoralizing. And I don't think that would be good for Palestinians, and I don't think it would be good for Israelis either. Look, the international community has for years sent a message to the Palestinians: abandon violence, abandon violence, abandon violence. We need to send Palestinians a message, very importantly, from the international community now, that if you choose nonviolence, we will support you. Because if you send them the message that they must abandon violence, and also send them the message that they must abandon nonviolence, the message that we're really sending them is that no resistance to oppression whatsoever is acceptable. And that is a recipe for catastrophe and ultimately a descent once again into violence, because that's where this will ultimately go. Palestinians are not going to accept living under conditions of oppression forever. There has to be a way to resist this, and the international community here plays a very big role. So I think it's important that these protests continue and be supported, not just for this particular moment in time, but because of the impact that it has on Palestinian strategy moving forward. It can be quite significant.
Okay. And, you know, in terms of assuming this does go on and assume kind of comparable form in the coming days or weeks, and Israel again feels threatened by it and is tempted to shoot people in response, how has the publicity played out so far from your point of view, in terms of how easy or hard it is for Israel to keep doing this as a political matter? So, for example, I described this video that circulated a lot on the internet of this guy carrying a tire, running away from Israeli troops. He's shot and killed. Has that been on CNN? Has that been on the CBS, NBC News? What is the media coverage of this looking like in those kinds of pragmatic terms to you?
So I haven't seen a whole lot of coverage of it on mainstream television news. There has been, you know, a good bit of coverage of it online and sort of the mainstream, you know, media outlets, their websites and so on. And you know, the content is there to be reported on. As you said, the videos are numerous, and I spent a good part of Friday covering that via Twitter and tweeting it out for people to see. The Israeli line on this is, you know, pretty straightforward all the time. If there are videos like the one that you referenced of a protester being shot in the back, one of the things they'll say is, well, you know, the video doesn't really show you the whole story, or they'll say that the video is fabricated, or they'll say that, you know, Palestinians made the whole thing up. there is a long list of Israeli excuses that are trotted out every time that there is incriminating video. And there is a history of that. There was a time where, Israeli soldiers were caught shooting two unarmed Palestinian children, 15-year-olds. And, you know, the video actually was captured by a CNN camera, and so it made it to CNN. And at the time, the former Israeli ambassador, Michael Oren, was a contributor, a CNN contributor, after his stint as ambassador. And in the segment that covered this, where Wolf Blitzer was hosting, he said, look, you know, you have two boys that were killed here. And the ambassador said, look, we don't even know if they're really dead, okay? And we don't know if this video is real. And of course, you know, these boys had been shot and killed and buried, and there was, you know, lengthy coverage of their funeral processions with hundreds of people, you know, attending them as well. But the Israelis will try to explain away even the unexplainable. And that's why I think it's so important that this kind of demonstration, this kind of resistance continues, because it puts the Israelis in a very difficult position of having to justify why they're doing these things. And I think, you know, when their justifications, their attempts at justification are out there and the videos are out there, people will make up their minds, and they won't make them up in a way that's favorable to Israel.
Okay. Now, of course, another thing Israel would say is, well, you have to understand, and again, I know I take your point, this was not a Hamas operation the way some things have been Hamas operations, but in general, a part of their get tough on Gaza policy has been couched in terms of Hamas and the fact that its official position is to not accept the legitimacy of, you know, a Zionist state or whatever. And so the Israel would say, well, look, Hamas is itself an existential threat. They have, they've never said that they could, live with A, B, or C. It's all or nothing. And so what do you say to that?
I mean, they can say whatever they want about Hamas, you know. I mean, it's really irrelevant to the fact that these are unarmed protesters that they're shooting at with live ammunition. It's completely irrelevant, you know. It's just not the way that the law works. I understand that they have their disagreements with Hamas. Hamas obviously feels very differently about the Israelis too. But that doesn't give Hamas the right to, you know, shoot at any unarmed Israeli just because the Israelis don't like Palestinians. That's not how this works, right? The Israelis have obligations under international law. And as far as it relates to, you know, dealing with unarmed protesters or anyone who doesn't present an imminent threat to life, you're not supposed to use live ammunition. They went down there with the intent to use live ammunition as policy to deal with these protesters. I think that's the big issue here. And whether, you know, Hamas exists in Gaza or the protesters are members of Hamas or not, if they're not posing a threat, you're not supposed to shoot and kill them. It's as simple as that.
Okay, so last kind of subject, I alluded to this. I asked you how you see this playing out in the short term in terms of this series of protests in Gaza. But to step back and look at the bigger picture and ask, like, where is this whole thing going? You know, for some years, it has seemed to me like it was basically too late for a two-state solution, in part because if you look at the Israeli settlements and the whole infrastructure built to support them, I mean, there's more and more, you know, people who have a stake in not withdrawing any settlements. And that just gets harder and harder politically from Israel's point of view. For a lot of reasons, it has just seemed like that's not realistic. And if you take, and I'm far from alone in this assessment, more and more people have been saying this, if you take that off the table, you know, it's like, well, you know, if you're talking about a one state solution, I guess you mean either the entry of Palestinians into the Israeli political system, which is, as Israelis will point out, would probably mean that before long Jews were a minority in Israel. They're not, so they don't find that attractive. Another form of the one state solution, I guess. Well, it's either explicit apartheid, that's one kind of one state solution, or a kind of ethnic cleansing that sends an appreciable number of Palestinians into Jordan or something. I mean, I just don't, I don't see like a good, a particularly good outcome down the road. You know, when you try to get optimistic about what could evolve here, what do you see?
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't think any plausible outcome is really ideal for either people. I think that there ultimately will be an agreement, a political accommodation, and there's going to have to be sacrifices on all sides. That's just the way that it's going to have to work out. What those sacrifices are the question. You know, the proposal that has been out there for the better part of the last 30 years has been this idea of land for peace and the principle of a two-state solution. If that doesn't work, and it's very clear, I think at this point that that's not going to work, then what changes is not that you don't continue working for peace, but you have to find a different formula. And I think the trade-off can no longer be land for peace for one of the reasons that you mentioned. The demographics are too intertwined at this point for there to be a realistic sort of separation. And the Israelis have no real interest in doing so. The trade-off at this point is about rights for peace and about the inclusion of Palestinians into a singular system. Obviously, if that's the case, there are going to have to be sacrifices that the Israelis are going to have to make as well. But, you know, the alternative of apartheid, which is the situation that we have today in the absence of some kind of accommodation, maybe that's the most attractive status quo for Israelis today. But over time, that's only going to get more costly because what we saw on the ground in Gaza, once the two-state paradigm is fully collapsed and this idea of negotiations for a Palestinian state are firmly part of history, what we saw on the ground in Gaza is going to become the norm, where you have routine confrontations between unarmed protesters and the Israeli state, you know, attempting to impose its will by brute force to keep these people subjugated. That's not something that's going to be able to sustain itself in the 21st century for a very long time. I don't think so. That's what the Israelis are facing. Ultimately, the decision lies with them, and it lies with people in the international community who are invested in this system, who have to also confront the choice of whether or not they find it acceptable. I don't think they should, and I don't think they will over the long term.
And do you think, like, the pressure you imagine, I guess, building that would make it impossible for Israel to sustain the status quo, is that highly dependent on pressure from the American government and or the American people? Because not a lot of that seems to be coming these days, or really ever. I mean, you know, you've seen more sympathy to the Palestinian cause in Europe. So is like pressure from Western Europe as a political matter, is that enough, or are you ultimately going to have to kind of flip an American administration on this issue? And, you know, you saw with Obama, who I think was in his heart somewhat sympathetic, but you saw how even he finds the political pressure pretty formidable, right? I mean, he had to wait until he was a lame duck, basically, to do something pretty forceful at the UN, which was not veto a resolution that Israel perceived as hostile. So I guess do you see strong American support for the Palestinian cause to be essential to resolving this? And if so, do you think that's realistic?
I do think America plays a key role, the key role. I do think you will see, you know, some changes in Europe over time, but even with Europe, we'll see change in Europe on this issue will not come before America gives it license to do so. They will follow America's lead ultimately, as they do on most things when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian issue. I do think that U.S. support for Israel in a good part is dependent on this idea that there is an Israeli-Palestinian solution on the horizon, right? Which is one of the reasons why the peace process is so instrumental, because there is a conflict between American values, right? The values that America claims to uphold, this idea of liberty and democracy and freedom and equal rights and all of these wonderful things, and the way that Israel is treating the Palestinians. And so for the United States to continue supporting Israel, there has to be at least this promise that there is a solution on the horizon, down the line, within reach, okay, in our imaginations. If that disappears, and I believe it's been disappearing, and people are forced to choose between supporting Israel as an apartheid state or not supporting Israel as an apartheid state, I think that changes the equation a lot. And I think over time, even the United States can change. I do think there are segments of the United States that probably will never change because their attachment to Israel is not really about the values that motivate many other people, the freedom and the democracy and the civil rights and all of that, but because of other ideological connections that, you know, are not contingent on those things. But I don't think that's the majority of Americans, and I don't think you need all of those people on board to see the kind of shift in the United States necessary to create pressure that would allow for an Israeli wake-up call. Mm-hmm. I don't think this is around the corner, but I do think it's imaginable in the future, especially given the direction that Israel is taking the situation on the ground.
So you think the sooner people realize that the two-state solution is dead, 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 the better?
Yeah, I think that's the case. I mean, look, right now, the only people that are still talking about a two-state solution are the Palestinians, the Palestinian Authority. The Israelis are not talking about it. The Americans, since the Trump administration, don't utter the words two-state solution. You know, the Europeans are still talking about it, but that's because, you know, they don't know what's going on in Washington under this administration. They're hoping the day will come where they can hit the reset button and things go back to where they were. But, you know, the Israelis right now, the other day, they announced that, you know, they're planning a major infrastructure project to build a railway system to settlements deep inside the West Bank that would cost hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, and are projected to be concluded, you know, in about 10 years. This is not a state that has any plans of leaving, right? They're making long-term plans to sink hundreds of millions of dollars of costs. Not next to the Green Line, but deep inside the West Bank, right? Their intentions are very clear. I think the sooner that people realize that that's the case, the sooner they have to confront Israel with making a choice. Either you're going to be a democracy or you're going to be an apartheid state. If you're going to be an apartheid state, and yes, this is an apartheid state, what we have today, then we simply cannot accept that. We're going to change our policy towards you. The sooner that confrontation comes, the better.
Okay, well, thank you for taking the time, Yusuf. So where can people find you on Twitter? What's your Twitter handle?
It's Yusuf Munayer, at Yusuf Munayer, okay. YUSEF MUNAYYER.
And we will link to that on the site. And then what about the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights? I guess they have a Twitter feed and a website and stuff?
Yes. Our website is uscpr.org, U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, the acronym.org, and you can find great information there about how to get involved in ways to actually challenge this situation.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I suspect we'll have occasion to check in with you again if you have time, because I don't think the situation's going to get resolved tomorrow. Take care.
Thank you, Bob.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.